Ephesians 3:13 suggests that Paul was concerned that his sufferings could discourage the Ephesian believers. Welcome to The Good Word. I am your host, Alden Thompson, Professor Emeritus in Biblical Studies from Walla Walla University. My conversation partners are John McVeigh, President of Walla Walla University, and Brent Berglund, current member of the Walla Walla University School of Theology. He, as well as John McVeigh, are both New Testament scholars. Indeed, John McVeigh has steeped himself in the study of Ephesians, focusing on the Pauline epistle for this his doctoral studies at the University of Sheffield in England. McVeigh is also the author of the official adult study guide, known in Adventist circles as the Quarterly. But in a sense, in the good word this quarter, we are plowing new ground because heretofore, the host has always been the author of the study guide. But in this case, Dr. McVeigh, whom I shall sometimes simply address as John, has not only written the Quarterly and the companion book available from the ABC, but has put together a rather monumental study guide, which is available online for your personal perusal. The question, if a leader's troubles threaten to undermine our faith, what does Paul suggest that we should do about that? Now, that's a question that's not raised in the book itself.
No, but it perhaps is hinted at, yes, because Paul raises this question. He's concerned about the situation that is going on in Ephesus, chapter 3, verse 13. So I ask you not to lose heart over what I'm suffering for you. And that seems to be part of why he is writing and talking about the things he is.
John, you suggested that there are some hints that Paul tells us what we should do if our leader begins to undermine our faith.
We're kind of skipping to chapter 3 here, right?
Yep.
And
I was going to ask you why you did that.
Well, I'm not quite sure. Paul talks about in chapter 3 this autobiographical sketch. He talks about his imprisonment, doesn't he? And it seems to be that he's concerned that the disciples in Ephesus that he's addressing have lost a little of their strong commitment to Christianity and their confidence that Christianity is important and valuable, because now their great hero, the one who was the evangelist who brought many of them to Christ and sparked and started the work in this great city, caused a riot and all the rest, he's in prison. And if he's in prison, you're in trouble. Paul goes on to say, listen, this is really actually part of God's plan. And it may not look like it on the surface, but in fact, God is at work in the midst of all of this.
Now, are we going to come to things like predestination in our study this quarter?
That particularly figures in Ephesians chapter 1, verses 3 through 14 that we talked about last week. But certainly that's something that addresses what we take to be local concerns. Okay, they worship all kinds of deities in Ephesus. They believe that various deities are over certain periods of time, a day, a month, a year, an hour. And the whole thing about ancient Greco-Roman religion here is worshiping the right deity at the right time, in the right way, in the hopes that, probably vain, but in the hopes that you might impact your future destiny. Now, you regard that destiny as having been pretty much set at the outset of your life, at your birth, by the particular conjunction of stars and planets that accompanied that birth. But still, magic is the only option you have. You got to try. And so you attempt to impact your destiny by doing obeisance to the right deity at the right moment. And so when Paul uses language like destined or predestined, he's not talking to members of democratic societies in free nations. He's talking to people who already know that their lives are completely destined by these various powers. And so what comes as good news to them is that their futures are actually destined by Jesus. That's the good news.
Okay.
And even in spite of what appear to be sidetracks like Paul's own imprisonment, that's part of the plan. That's part of the destiny that God has in Christ. I might even go through difficulty, and I can know that even that is acceptable in Christ. It's part of the purpose.
Well, you know, C.S. Lewis, and I've puzzled at this a fair bit, says at one point, if there is providence at all, then everything is providential, and every providence is a special providence. Now, I like that as a heuristic principle. It works for me better than pray without ceasing. If I'm thinking that whatever happened is something that's important as far as God's plan for me is, then I have to stop and think all the time. I misplaced something. Well, what's God's plan for that? Well, it may be that I will find something that I didn't even know was lost. So there are several ways of doing that, and I find that heuristically a very thing. And I don't know, we don't really want to take time here to explore about how each of you deal with providence and God's plan for your life. There are many times when things happen that we think are pretty catastrophic and we can't figure out what in the world the Lord was up to. And that may be part of Paul's story here as well. Now, you've given the title here, John, The Power of the Exalted Jesus. And I've noted that you use the word power.
Yes. Yes.
He uses the word power four times.
Yes. This is a prayer report. Okay, it's one of these worship passages, and Paul is reporting on how he prays for the people, for the disciples, the believers, the followers of Jesus in Ephesus. And so he's especially interested that the Spirit will come into their lives. He believes that has happened to them at conversion. So we would understand this as a fresh infusion of the Spirit, who would remind them of three things: the hope of God's call, verse 18, the riches of the glory of God's inheritance in the saints, also verse 18, and number three, where he spends most of his time, is the exceeding greatness of God's power exercised on behalf of believers. You need to know just how grand God's power is that he's ready to put into play in your lives and your experiences. And then he points to four salvation history events where that power is rooted: the resurrection of Jesus, verse 20a, seating Jesus at his right hand. These are all four things that God the Father does for Christ. He raises him from the dead. He seats him at his right hand. He puts all things under his feet, verse 22a, and he gives him as head of all things. He's just given him, he's just made him head of all things, and now he gives him as head of all things to the church. And so Paul says, you look at those four salvation historic events, not all of them real familiar to us, but study those four events. That's the kind of power that you have available to you through the Spirit in your life.
But John, I have a question, if you don't mind me asking, and that is, in today's world, much is said and discussed about this topic of power, and we tend to view power in a negative light. People have exercised and used power in unjust ways, and we speak of people who are oppressed by power. How should I read this in light of such a kind of a worldview where power is to be eschewed?
Yeah, I think you have to read it in the first century context, where we have record of scores of deities and powers that are worshipped in Ephesus, and people were on a quest for power. Not the kind of raw organizational or political power that we often mean. They meant power to live life, power to get through the day, that kind of
to get
power.
Their crops in.
To get their crops in, to find the fish they needed in the sea, and so on and so forth. They're looking for help. They're looking for power in that sense. And I think we ought to read it in that first century context.
That's helpful.
Okay. Now, going through there, and I noticed when you went, there are echoes, well, the way you put it in your study guide was that Paul is echoing Psalm 110 and Psalm 8.
Yes, because he concludes this glorious prayer report, mm-hmm. this worship passage, chapter 1, verses 15 through 22, with pointing to the exaltation of Jesus mm-hmm. and his appointment over all things and his being given to the church. And this is grand language. So it is, you can kind of trace the stages of an enthronement ceremony mm-hmm. here. This one is odd because it begins with a resurrection from the dead, mm-hmm. right? And then comes the enthronement. The Father seated Christ at his right hand in the heavenly places. The next event might be labeled the subjugation. Mm-hmm. Charles recently became Charles III of the UK, and he had the domains of the UK, the Commonwealth nations, subjugated to him in a part of the ceremony, mm-hmm. Recognized that they are in some sense in service to him. And in this case, in the case of King Jesus, the scope of his domain is boundless. It encompasses all things. And he, God the Father, put all things under his feet.
Now, do you think the ordinary believer would pick up the echoes of the Psalms when they're reading this?
It's a very good question, because you think of these believers in Ephesus as coming from a pagan environment. Mm-hmm. But so we have to ask, you know, is Paul simply using this because it's part of his background, or does he expect them to connect with it? I get the impression, based upon the use of the expansive use of the Old Testament in this letter, mm-hmm. That he expects that through Christian worship, perhaps through some exposure to the Jewish synagogue and so on, they will have had enough exposure to some of these great texts that he refers to that they will recognize them as coming from the Jewish scriptures. Okay.
And there's no question Psalm 110 being a messianic psalm is the single most quoted psalm in the New Testament. Yeah. And yet here it's simply alluded to as if it's mm-hmm. already understood.
Now, our time is almost up, but I wanted to pop one more question for you, John. Do you think that, I mean, this exaltation, don't you think that might be more likely to appeal to the Brits than to Americans?
Yes, but we all need it, because we all have a battle in our lives with regard to whom and to what will we do subservience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To whom will we bow the knee?
Yep.
And so what this amazing description of the exaltation of Jesus invites us to do is to do a check.
Okay.
Where do our loyalties lie? Are we indeed kneeling at the feet of Jesus?
So we can still learn something from the Brits.
Yep, we can.
Okay. Today we've explored how the book of Ephesians presents the power of the exalted Jesus. I want to thank our participants, John McVeigh and Brent Berglund, my conversation partners, and Kristen Byerly, our program engineer. A grateful TY to each of you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.